ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In the course of my travels, I've been recording nature soundscapes with the aim of helping you, Australia, to relax. And in this particular overnight recording, there was this one duck that just kept screaming its guts out. Anyway, don't worry, I've selected only the best, most relaxing soundscapes that absolutely do not feature this duck. Find Nature Sounds by Anne Jones wherever you get your podcasts and on the ABC Listen app.
This is Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. The cast of kings and prophets, poets and assassins is long. Their lands stretch from the Atlantic coast of Africa to the edge of Russia. Their quarrels go back into the midst of time, but Cauldron, the latest book by the historian Simon Sebag Montefiore, is a history of the last 125 tumultuous years of the Middle East. It's an amazing feat of storytelling. It's unexpected and enthralling. The sweep is huge and the details are delicious. How would any of us know, except by reading Cauldron, that the King of Saudi Arabia, Abdulaziz, was a fan of Sherlock Holmes, or that NASA had the title role in a school production of Julius Caesar? Sebag Montefiore has written best-selling histories of Stalin, Catherine the Great, and Jerusalem, and he calls Cauldron, full title, Cauldron, The Making of the Modern Middle East, a chronicle of war and love, dreams and desperation, fanaticism and tolerance. He joins me now from London. Simon, welcome to the show.
Great to be talking to you. Hi.
Simon, the Middle East, of course, is deep in your family, from, indeed, the Moroccan coast to Israel, what is now Israel. Is that sort of ever present in you when you're writing this book? Was it a reason for writing the book?
Originally, it was a reason for my being interested in Middle Eastern history. Just as my Russian roots were kind of an inspiration for doing my Russian books. And I've really kind of concentrated my career on Russia and the Middle East. I was always brought up with knowing kind of two things. One is that the Sebags, which is part of my family, came from Morocco, from Marrakesh and Essaouira, and lived there for centuries. And that through the Montefiores, I had a connection to the Holy Land and Jerusalem from the early 19th century onwards. And so those two things were always part of my upbringing and an inspiration for writing histories of the Middle East.
And investigating its mysteries.
It's many mysteries.
You write that history in this region seems more alive than anywhere else, the past less dead.
I think that's true in the Middle East because history is taken so seriously there. And of course, it's merged with religion there, which gives it a sort of lethal propulsion. But I do think we're living in an era when history is becoming much more important and less known at the same time. And the reason it's becoming more important is, I think, because religion in the West has become less influential. And we think we're living in secular times. And in the absence of religion, history has a sort of authentic power, moral power. And that's why, you know, for example, Vladimir Putin wrote a history essay before he invaded Ukraine. So I think history is pretty important everywhere now. But the problem is getting dependable history, balanced history, history based on facts and sources. And that's what I'm trying to do with this. This is meant to be a history of the Middle East over the last 125 years that anyone can read. And that just explains how we got to where we are.
You say quite bluntly that the history of this particular stretch of the world is almost the most contested history we will ever know. And so for every history, there are other versions, other accounts. But your plan is to drive down the middle. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, you mentioned my background and my family connections. I mean, that is always in my mind in two ways. First of all, because, you know, that inspired my knowledge, and that's how I came to know the region, including Morocco, but also the Holy Land. But in another sense, every historian reflects in part who they are and the time they live in, the present that they live in. And so my constant awareness is to always make sure that this is balanced and to test oneself all the time. And that of course, is a challenge, whatever history you're writing, whatever preconceptions you have. And my basic rule in this book has been that, you know, you mention everything, good or bad, about everybody, and that you have no hierarchy of who are goodies, who are baddies, and that everyone counts or no one counts.
Do you think we read the history of the Middle East with particular attention because we hope that it will warn us how to avoid the catastrophes that have occurred in the last century?
That's right, I think. We look to avoid mistakes that have been made in the past, of course. We also look for judgment about how these decisions were made, who made them. And we also look for truth, in that we know we're receiving a blizzard, a tsunami of slogans and banners and often misinformation. And people really want to know what truth is there in this? How much truth is there in this? And that is my mission here, really. Of course, it's difficult, and it's never going to be absolutely perfect. But, you know, I've bent over backwards, really, in this book, first of all, just to try and get as close as I can to what really happened. And usually, I don't sort of assign blame. I just let people tell it in their own words. And then you can judge it, whether it's King Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia, or Abdulhamid of the Ottoman Empire, or Ben Gurion, or Arafat, or Hamas, you know, or Erdogan, or any of these people. I basically tell the story as close as I can to what happened, without assigning villainy or perfection to anybody. And you can judge the reader, you know why and how it happened. But I also am writing a book that I want to be read widely, and my books are read by people who don't know history. And I'm also writing it what I hope is an entertainment that is exciting to read.
Well, 1901 gives you a couple of remarkably clear starting points for a history of the Middle East. One is the arrival of Abdulaziz bin Abdulrahman Al Saud in what he will one day call Saudi Arabia. And that, November 1901, begins a whole stretch of this history.
That's the point. And in making that, I mean, first of all, I'm always looking with my books for an opening scene that will be dramatic, exciting, novelistic, cinematic.
Yes.
But also one that actually is one of the most telling moments in the book. And this is an example of that. Most books in the Middle East start after World War One with a whole bunch of British and French and Americans deciding what to do in the Middle East. I deliberately started it much earlier, 20 years earlier, because, first of all, this is a Middle Eastern history of the Middle East, in the sense that I really concentrate on the Arabs, the Kurds, the Jews, the peoples of the peoples of the Middle East, and I want it to be about their agency, their story, and so this is a cauldron of many peoples, and obviously, foreigners and Westerners are very much part of it. We've got Churchill, we've got Truman, we've got FDR, we've got Stalin. All the way up to Putin and Trump. But I start there because this is about the Middle East, and this is how really the key country of the Middle East today, Saudi Arabia, was founded.
And in the same year, and almost at the same time, a deal is done to explore for oil in Iran. There is a concession signed to explore for oil in Iran, and that seems like a pretty good starting point for a history of the Middle East too.
That's another key point that happens to be around then as well. And that is decisive. And you're absolutely right. I mean, even when Alexander the Great was marching across Persia, all those thousands of years, more than 2,000 years ago, oil was bubbling up through the ground around those areas. So, and he saw that, and his troops were sort of, saw the oil and wrote about it and talked about it. So, yes, this is the moment that another aspect of the Middle East became essential to the Western powers, and that was oil, because this is on the edge of the car, the engine, you know, which is of course fueled by carbon fuels, becoming universal in the world, the internal combustion engine. And it's also the moment that it's not long before Winston Churchill starts to fuel the Royal Navy, the greatest fleet in the world at this time, with oil. And this oil all comes from Anglo-Persian, which is now BP, this oil that was soon found in the Middle East in Iran. And of course, this made Iran, and then soon afterwards Iraq, where they also found oil, this made these two places increasingly essential to Britain then, and of course later to the United States, which there's always in every page of this book, there are echoes of what's happening today.
So, yes.
You know, when you talked about the founding prince of Saudi Arabia galloping into Riyadh and taking the city in 1902, you know, we are now looking at Saudi Arabia ruled by his grandson, who is close to Trump, who is now just signing a treaty with the Turks and the Pakistanis. When we're talking about oil and the Darcy oil deal that was signed back in 1901, you know, we're now talking about the Third Gulf War and what is going to happen in the Straits of Hormuz. Every single place we look at, we find an echo and an explanation of how we got there. And that's the fun of this book.
There's a theme also right from the very beginning, which fascinates me in this book. It's the theme of rulers, often from ancient houses, deciding to modernize. And in the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan, Abdul Hamid, had been modernizing. What does modernizing in the Middle East mean? How well does it go?
What it meant to the Ottoman Empire was making the Ottoman Empire stronger. And you know, in the West, we have a fatal weakness for always thinking that people that are modernizing and reforming are definitely going to be constitutional liberal Democrat. And
yes.
Of course, we're always wrong about that, as we have been about Putin, for example. And Abdul Hamid was modernizing. And by modernizing, he meant railways and clock towers and a streamlined organization. He also meant telegraphs and up-to-date spying. And his
secret police are a big part of modernization in the Middle East.
Yes, secret police are, you know, one of the big developments. And in fact, you know, it's fascinating because he was one of the inventors of secret police, but he was also such a contradictory figure. He wrote Verdi lyrics for operas. He loved Sherlock Holmes. He was a carpenter. He was a poet, but he was also an autocrat, an extremely shrewd statesman, a ruthless killer, and the master of the first modern secret police. And it was said, and I believe this is true, it's a myth, but I think it's true, that he had an agent in Buckingham Palace who would get him to see Queen Victoria's telegrams before before they left Buckingham Palace, which is a sort of Downton Abbey detail.
It's completely wonderful detail. Completely wonderful. I wonder if you would agree with me that the most important decision in the whole of this history from, you know, the last 125 years was the decision of the Ottoman Empire to back Germany in the First World War. Nearly everything about the Middle East flows from that disastrous decision.
Yes, and of course, we are still seeing the fallout from the Ottoman Empire now in the organization of the Middle East. You know, you can't really understand anything that's happening in 2026 without understanding how it was ruled in the Ottoman Empire. And that's why I begin in 1900, in fact. People tend to think that the Ottoman Empire was rather lovely, kind of tolerant institution where everyone was singing kumbaya and living in, you know, Jews and Arabs and Christians were all living together happily. There were moments when that was true, but they were very short. And the last regime of the Ottoman Empire, the three pashas, were really proto-Nazis who believed in a eugenicist social Darwinism. And they basically believed in asserting Turkish nationhood by war and killing. And they believed that that alone would save the nation and the empire. And in World War I, they embarked on a series of genocides, including the Armenians, 1.1 million, the Pontic Greeks, 300,000, and so on. And these massacres are now, you know, we have all the evidence of them, all their telegrams and everything. And of course, it's not a coincidence that Hitler said, as he was planning the Holocaust, said, you know, who now remembers the Armenians?
Indeed. And on the other side, meanwhile, as the World War One got underway, the Allies were promising anything to everyone who would join their side. You write, by the spring of 1916, Russia, Greece, Italy, and the Armenians had also been made vast and contradictory promises, and more were to come. And the contradictions here have terrible outcomes, don't they?
Terrible outcomes. Well, most of them don't happen at all. And some of the promises are very famous. So we all know about the promise to the Arabs, and we know about the promise to the Jews. But actually, neither of those two, which are the most famous, and because their stories, their grievances, their conflict goes on today. But neither of these are actually quite what they seem. The promise to the Arabs is a promise to one family, the Hashemite family, that its only power and experience was ruling one small but very famous town, the holy city of Mecca. And they literally commanded about 2,000 men there. And they were demanding the whole Arab world as their personal empire. Literally, they were demanding Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, and Jordan, literally. And so the British wanted them to join the war against the Ottomans, but they deliberately befogged the promise because, of course, it was not deliverable in that form. And at the same time, if we look at the Balfour Declaration, the promise to the Jews, it promised a homeland, not of Palestine, but in Palestine. And a homeland can mean just about anything. They certainly weren't promising a state. And actually, most of the early Jewish nationalists, the Zionists, didn't want a state either. They were interested in founding small farming communities. Most of them were socialists or communists. So those are the two promises. But what people miss out is there's a plethora of other promises, all even more contradictory, that people don't know about so much. And you listed them earlier. So first of all, they promised the French that they would get Syria and Lebanon and probably Palestine as well as everybody else. Then there's the promise to the Russians. The Russians were promised not only Constantinople, Istanbul, and half of Turkey. But also, and this is what people don't realize, in the Sykes-Picot-Sazonov agreement, they were also promised Jerusalem and Palestine, that they were going to rule with the French and the British. And then there's others. Then there's the Greeks, who were promised the western half of Turkey and Constantinople if the Russians didn't have it, and the Italians and the Kurds and the Armenians. So you get the picture.
It is a wonder that the confusion was not even greater after the First World War.
Well, it was very confusing because, of course, it led to a series of wars, some of which are still going on.
As they tend to do in the Middle East. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm speaking to Simon Sebag Montefiore about his marvellous new history of the Middle East in the last 125 years, called The Cauldron. Simon, is one of the determining things in this history that the Middle East imported European nationalism, and it was never going to fit because the Middle East never had those kinds of clear territories of race and faith and family ownership, etc. It was much too complex for European nationalism to really flourish.
I think that's right. And that is one of the themes of the book. One of the themes of the book is that we often look at the Middle East and wonder the influences on it, and we think of Islam as an influence. But actually, you know, there's two-way traffic here. And the Middle East influences the West influences the Middle East, and the priority of those changes all the way through the book. But yes, in the late 19th century, the Middle East became very influenced by Western nationalism, European nationalism, which had worked in places like the Balkans, because everyone was Orthodox Christian, basically, mostly. And so they created new states like Greece and Serbia and Romania, etc. But once it came to the Middle East, of course, all the peoples in the Middle East embraced nationalism too. So it wasn't just that it was imposed by Western powers. The Arabs became Arab nationalists. The Kurds became Kurdish nationalists. The Armenians became Armenian nationalists. The Jews became Jewish nationalists. And everyone wanted a nation state. But you're right that the problem was that many of the areas of the Middle East are not suited to nation states, because in nation states, there's a dominant nation. And that dominant nation is often imposes itself on people who don't fit. So all of these peoples, and including the Turks, the Arabs, the Jews, all Armenians, all these peoples embraced these ideas of nation states, but nation states didn't fit because the Middle East is an interwoven patchwork of all sorts of ethnicities and sects and so on, and religions that live beside each other. And at their best, they coexist and respect each other. But they only really respect each other when historically one power was in charge. And over the sort of 1,000 years, basically, that goes before us today, that has been an Islamic power. And everyone could exist, provided they recognized the total supremacy of the Sultan, the Caliph in Istanbul, you know, in other words, Islam. And that just about worked, though with kind of interspersed with massacres and revolutions and uprisings and pogroms and all the rest of it. But when the Ottoman Empire fell and they started to create these new states, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Palestine, these states had never existed before as states. And they encompass all sorts of peoples. For example, in Lebanon, you know, you've got Druze, you've got Turkmen, you've got Shias, you've got Sunnis, you have Maronites, Christians, Orthodox Christians. So all of these communities were now encompassed in these new states, and they had to somehow work out how to rule them And that's in part why you get people like Nasser and Saddam Hussein and the Assads channeling a tradition of authoritarian rule in the region. Partly they are claiming that they are the only people who can stop the rise of Islamism. And partly they are just self-aggrandizing dictators and their children trying to rule forever and doing so with absolute Caligularian brutality.
And in the process of all of this, as you write in the book, those cosmopolitan cities, those cosmopolitan societies, which had survived for centuries, begin to disappear. And the societies become, I think you called them recently, bleak binary nationalism, which is a huge loss.
Well, it's a tragedy. And it's writing the book, you know, you can just feel it getting less and less representative. And this is especially true in the Arab countries. For example, in 1956, Egypt had been for 1,000 years, for 2,000 years, an amazingly cosmopolitan country. So there were Arabs there, but there were also Christian Copts. There were Jews, there were Greeks, there were Levantines and Lebanese, there were Italians, but in huge communities. And Egypt was one of the most exciting and fun places to live, to be. And this had really started with Alexander the Great founding Alexandria, you know, back in the third and fourth century BC. And this continued right up. And you see it with King Farouk, for example, the last monarch of Egypt, you know, who had mistresses. He had Arab mistresses, Jewish mistresses, Muslim mistresses, Christian mistresses, Americans, Italians, you name it. And, you know, and so that was one of the great strengths of the Egyptian economy, this incredible richness with all these very entrepreneurial communities. In 56, after the Suez Crisis, Nasser declares, you know, he's an Arab nationalist, and he starts to expel all these people. Not just the Jews, though that's part of it, but also all these other Egyptianized peoples who've been there for centuries. And the Egyptian economy has never recovered. Or look at Iraq. You know, in 2000, there were 1 million Christians in Iraq. There are now 150,000. So, you know, in 1900, 25% of the Middle East was Christian. Now it's 4%. So this is really happening, particularly in the Arab countries more than anywhere else. And it's a great tragedy.
And one of the stories you tell in the book, once again, is the tragedy of the expulsion of the Greeks from Anatolia, which was still going on in the 1960s, wasn't it? They were still clearing Greeks out of Istanbul in the 1960s. Extraordinary
right,
times.
Right.
Oh, Simon, you've yes. mentioned a figure from my childhood, King Farouk. What a pleasure he is to come across in the book. What an appalling fat wastrel he was. How did he survive so long?
Well, I mean, the English allowed him to survive. And if one's fair to him, as I try to be, while enjoying his excesses, because he was a total sybarite and a sex addict, an eating addict, a bulimic, a pickpocket. He was a narcissist. You know, he pickpocketed Churchill. Churchill was very unamused by that, as you can imagine.
What, literally took something from his pocket?
Yeah, he took his watch from his waistcoat.
Oh.
And he was actually quite a good pickpocket, considering that he was virtually the richest man in the world. He also, you know, he lived an extraordinary life. He became vastly wealthy because his cotton plantations sort of boomed in the late 30s and in the war and after the war. And he became even richer than he had been before. When he succeeded to the throne in 1936, he was so popular in Egypt. He was the first Egyptian ruler to speak Arabic. All his father and all the others all spoke Turkish.
Right. And he was young and beautiful.
He was beautiful as a young man. He was the sort of, he was a handsome, extremely handsome. Of course, he wasn't actually really Arab at all. He was essentially a Albanian Turk, and which, you know, which the ruling family were descended from someone called Muhammad Ali the Great, who took power in 1806. But the point was that once he'd survived World War II, he really wanted to, first of all, assert autocracy in Egypt, throw the British out, and really he had to balance Arab nationalism and Islamism, personified by the Muslim Brotherhood that came from Egypt. And so he had to balance these two things. And, you know, he wasn't really politically skilled enough to do so. And he entered the war against Israel in 1948, but performed so corruptly and incompetently that in 1952, he was overthrown by Colonel Nasser in a coup, the Free Officers' Coup, and went into exile. And, you know, that was the end of the monarchy in Egypt. But he was a fascinating character. And Nasser, of course, was another big character who, in fact, ironically, also was destroyed by being defeated by Israel. But Nasser was a much more impressive personality and also much more destructive. I mean, Nasser promised so much. He was tall. He was handsome. He was articulate. He spoke brilliantly. He was funny. He'd read everything. He was just an extraordinary character. But he also created the Arab secret police state, expelled all the foreigner, the sort of people who weren't Arabs from Egypt, many of them, in 1956, and then brought Egypt closer and closer to war with Israel, and in the end threatened to destroy Israel, and Israel preemptively attacked. But he was so intelligent and sort of brave in a way that after 1967, where he was a kind of broken man, but he realized that Egypt must make peace with Israel and recognize Israel. And, and so before he died, he'd made that decision that Sadat later put into action.
We'll get back to 1967, but first I want to go to post-war situation in Iran. And I'm wondering if you would rate also as an absolutely key event, and again, a key decision of the time, was the decision of the Anglo-Iranian oil company not to accept a 50-50 split of the profits from Iran's oil fields.
Yeah, I mean, that was just like a basic mistake. They were so arrogant, the British oil executives, and the British government couldn't quite get them to do what they wanted. But equally, another mistake was made by the Iranian Prime Minister Mossadegh, when he didn't make a share deal with the British and American oil interests, which he should have done. But he was frightened that he'd be assassinated if he did, as one of his predecessors had very recently. And so he never made the deal. And as a result, he floundered. And he went from kind of wild popularity in Iran to having to essentially repress parliament and rule autocratically. And that lost him a lot of support. And the key support he lost was among the clergy, and the sort of leader of the Shia clergy at that time was called Ayatollah Kashani, and Ayatollah Kashani kind of initially supported him and then switched to support the Shah, and supported the coup that the army led against Mossadegh, and that brought the Shah, you know, roaring back to power in the coup, in the Iranian coup, which is a notorious event. But the actual story of what happened in the coup against Mossadegh is one of those, another one of those stories that the reality is entirely different from the ideological story that has become absolutely accepted as the conventional wisdom. But read the book to see what actually happened. It's a little more complicated.
Yes. Yeah, entirely different, or just much more complicated, much more interesting, because he was still essentially overthrown by Western powers because he threatened to nationalize the oil. Is that not still the fundamental driver for the intervention of the Western powers to back instead the Shah and his regime?
Well, I think one's got to challenge that story when you read about it really carefully.
Right.
You've got to realize, you've got to ask why this story has become regarded as the authorized version. And the reason is because the CIA were desperate to boast that about their power and finesse and cunning. And so it was a story that that America loved, because it showed that America was so powerful that it could intervene in a country and just fix everything.
Yep.
And at the same time, that story came to suit, ironically, exactly the opposite people, the Iranian nationalists and the Islamists, who were keen to say that America had just seized power in Iran, another example of wicked imperialism. But what happened, in fact, is that many Iranian interests were keen to overthrow Mossadegh by the time that he was overthrown. And as I said, Ayatollah Kashani is the decisive one, because let's face it, the Shiite clergy, as we now know, are extremely influential in Iran. And when they switch sides, and when he went to back the coup, I would suggest that that is more important than the CIA's one agent in one major agent, Kermit Roosevelt.
There's a very funny portrait of Kermit Roosevelt in your book. Very funny portrait.
He's a fantasist. He's a ludicrous fantasist. He doesn't speak any Persian. He has no contacts. And he's a shocking racist. All he does, if you read about it, is say how slimy and incompetent and cowardly the Iranians are,
yes,
unlike him. And when Eisenhower read his report, Eisenhower said, "This just reads like a novel." Another part of that story is that the Americans sent £1 million to $1 million to buy the coup. Well, even if you read Kermit Roosevelt's completely fantasy account, you'll see that he said, "We only spent 100 of it." So in fact, they did attempt a coup, but the coup was simply for the Shah to dismiss the prime minister, which he was entirely legally allowed to do. He tried to do that, and that failed. So if that was the American coup failed. And if you read the CIA reports, which I quote in the book, they say this has failed ignominiously, we better give up. But the fact is, the army and the clergy had decided that Mossadegh needed to go. And so there's a second coup, behind which the Americans and the British are present, but the agency is down to the army officers and the clerk and Kashani, and the second coup did succeed. So it's a story of two coups, and the American and British one was the first one, didn't quite succeed, but you know, the world of espionage is a murky and shadowy one. And, you know, of course, the British and Americans played their role and were conspiring to overthrow Mossadegh. But there's a lot more going on here than just that.
On Late Night Live, I'm talking to Simon Sebag Montefiore about his new history of the last century or so in the Middle East. Simon, you mentioned Mossadegh's fear of assassination, and one of the themes of this book, I don't know whether it's a conscious theme in your writing, is assassination. There are assassinations the entire time. Was there ever a time and place in history when assassination counted for so much?
It's what the CIA call a target-rich environment. And this this book is filled with not just assassination, but espionage and spying. And, you know, everybody has their own secret police. The Arab leaders have the Mukhabarat, the Shah has SABAC, the Islamic Republic has its security minister, its ruthless security minister, and other paramilitary formations. Every terrorist organization has its own secret police within it. And of course, then you've got, you know, there's some very famous security services in this. I mean, not just the CIA and MI6, but we've also got the Jordanian, you know, secret service that is very competent. And then you've got the Mossad, you know, the Israeli secretaries, which is the most legendary of all. And all of these people are using assassins and secret police. I mean, Saddam Hussein, for example, is a classic example. He has about 10 different secret police agencies that are all spying on each other. And they're all led by members of his family, cousins, half-brothers, and they're all going against each other. And they all have kind of ever more crazy names, you know, like the Secret Committee of Public Security, et cetera, et cetera. And they're all assassinating people for him. And one of the key moments in the book is in 1978, when Saddam Hussein rings up the Shah of Iran and says, "Would you like me to assassinate Ayatollah Khomeini?" And the Shah, rather grandly, regards Saddam Hussein as quite impressive, but obviously he regards the Iraqis as savages. So he says, like, "Certainly not, we don't do that sort of thing," which of course is totally untrue. He does assassinate his opponents, like everybody does in the region, but he doesn't want to take a favor from Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein then sends his brother-in-law, Barzan al-Tikriti, to Tehran to make the offer again, just to make sure. But the Shah decides it's a bad idea. It might make Khomeini into more of a martyr and more of a hero and more of a threat. So he says no. And so Saddam throws out Khomeini and offers him to the French, and the French accept him and give him sanctuary outside Paris. And that's where he manages, like the political, brilliant political player that he is, the Ayatollah Khomeini, to hold together this extraordinary alliance of a coalition of different parts of the Iranian political core. So he has, you know, Democrats and liberals, he has Marxists and Leninists, he has his Islamists and extreme Islamists, and he holds them all together by inscrutable playing and acting, really. So to the foolish Western liberals and leftists, he plays the rather sort of pacific, gentle, kind, serene father figure. And of course, everyone falls for it. And, you know, there are lots of there are articles in the New York Times saying this man is the new Gandhi. He's finally, we've got a wonderful anti-colonialist humanitarian who's so gentle and loving and incorruptible. Anyway, and so he comes back to Iran in 79, the Shah flees, and then a series of events help him to set up this new regime that is basically is based on this extraordinary idea that an Islamic scholar could be the kind of ruler, the absolute ruler of Iran. And he'd invented this idea in 1970, and everyone thought it was a kind of like just a crazy gambit. But of course, he wanted himself to fulfill that role. And thanks to certain things, including Saddam Hussein and Iraq invading Iran, he was able to rally the regime and to create a supreme leader role, which was senior to everybody and actually was a sort of sacred monarch of Iran. And he was able to basically suppress and murder all the others who'd helped put him in power in a series of blood purges that created the Islamic Republic.
And this was a kind of brand new invention, which the West rather read as kind of the ancient revival of Islamic powers, but it was new.
It was new. And I think that's the point. I mean, everyone in the West is very confused by religious leadership, I think, because we don't really know how to cope with it. But we suspect that it's rather passionate and very ancient and always rather benign, a bit like the Pope. And in fact, yes, it isn't like that at all. And, you know, we made that mistake with Ayatollah Khomeini. But if you look at the coverage in the Western press of the supreme leaders of Iran, you'll see that no one ever really criticizes them and just calls them. They, you know, essentially, they are literally the most bloodthirsty dictators of modern times. And they rank up there with people like Stalin and Mao and Hitler and so on. But they're always treated with a certain respect, because I think we're just a bit confused about, we secretly, in our waterily secular societies, we are secretly somewhat impressed with religious people and afraid of them.
Yes, and admire their mysterious powers in some strange way. Simon, there's a great deal in the book, of course, about Palestine, about the creation of Israel. One of the things that impressed me a great deal in the book is your argument about the impact of the Six-Day War on Israel. And you argue, in fact, that in a way, it puts the survival of Israel in doubt.
So I think in the case of the Six-Day War, it was a perfect opportunity for Israel to negotiate with those lands that it conquered in 67 and to work out some sort of arrangement. And the best arrangement would have been with Egypt and with Jordan. And, you know, those deals were probably doable in some form or other. But Israel was intoxicated with the excitement of this victory and the excitement of finally having been banned from Jerusalem and banned from the wall in Jerusalem, which was the last wall of the temple. And having been in such desperate struggles to survive, they had literally gone from a sort of panic that they were going to be literally exterminated to winning a war against everybody. And I think that this blessing unleashed a sort of military Zionism, a military Jewish nationalism that was linked to messianic hopes. And that process is still going on. Most Israelis are still secular, centrist, tolerant, and desperate to find a way to get peace and recognition for Israel so that they don't have to fight wars permanently. But a small group who one can really trace their rise to 67, but a small group of extremists who only represent, if you look at the voting figures, about 10% of Israel, but they have a different agenda altogether. And there are extremist ministers from that, from those parties in the government today. And you see the distorting effect in what is happening today. And I believe that they represent a pretty serious threat to Israel itself, to the survival of the state.
Do you think one of the problems for the Middle East is that the boundaries have been redrawn so often that somehow in people's minds they are malleable, and therefore for those Israelis who want the old original Holy Land back again, it just seems so easy to redraw the boundaries?
Well, the boundaries, but that's partly because the boundaries aren't, I mean, the boundaries that we're talking about, the Green Line, for example, the lines that were agreed in 1948 at the end of the war, they are just armistice lines. And so, which became international law. But one of the themes of the book is, yes, you know, the borders there were all just drawn either by war or by Western imperialist statesmen. And I do think that one of the things we're going to see in the next 10 years, maybe sooner, is redrawing of some of these borders and, you know, which have held together for more than 80 years. But I think that many of the states will change shape, and there'll be secessions, there'll be additions, and so I think we're going to see a widespread challenge to the sort of 1945, 1918 in settlement. But I think another point is, you know, when you mentioned the borders, the 67 borders, for example, I mean, they are not defensible borders. You can't really defend a state that is 9 miles wide at its narrowest, as Israel is, by those borders. And so, you know, the borders need to be with a peaceful entity. And that's the only way that there can be peace there. I think in the Western press, it's always emphasized that Israel must make more concessions, and Israel must surrender things, must step back. And I believe that that is essential. But what's missing from that picture is we must also expect big concessions and stepping back from the Palestinian side too. It's only when both are willing to make pretty substantial concessions that there's anything to talk about.
But how can Palestinians step back any further than they are now? They're living in tents and in the rubble of their destroyed civilization, and on the West Bank, they're being picked off by thugs.
Yes, and I think that the tragedy of the Palestinian suffering is something that has to be solved urgently. And I'm a big believer, as I argue in the book, that a Palestinian state is essential. But at the moment, the trauma of the Palestinians, having lost so many civilians in Gaza, being harassed by Jewish supremacists in the West Bank, is an extremely difficult one. But their trauma is so raw. And the same goes for the Israelis. The Israelis, after October 7th and the Hamas massacres of civilians and the rapes, they are also suffering from PTSD. And it's going to take a while before either of them feel confident enough or safe enough to make concessions to each other. But be under no illusion, some sort of version of this is the only way forward. And both sides must recognize each other, must start a process of negotiation. And even though a two-state idea seems a long way off now, almost impossible, it isn't. It is feasible, but it's very difficult. And I don't use the expression two-state solution because I don't think there'll ever be a solution. And what do states mean now? But I call it two republics, two nations. And that is my greatest dream. And my other greatest dream is just to see the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza lifted as soon as possible. And I'm a great critic of Donald Trump, but the 20 point plan is a sensible plan for how to get there. So we must just pray that the conditions of Gaza are improved, negotiations are begun, and we begin to move forward. And I'm an optimist ultimately, but in the short term, it's impossible to be an optimist.
Simon, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much.
I have been talking to Simon Sebag Montefiore about his new book, Cauldron, The Making of the Modern Middle East. And that's the show. At 82, Joe Biden thought he had another term in him. Trump is 80 and nodding off for all to see. From the White House down, says Yale professor Samuel Moyne, America is being run by geriatrics. Power and money are hoarded by the old. How has it come to this, and what hope is there for the young, ever turning the tables? That's next.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.